You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 14th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at Columbia University, author of the Chartbook newsletter on Substack, and author of his most recent Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy, Adam Tooze will be joining us. Meanwhile, California votes on the recall as Democrats have deployed the kitchen sink. Not literally. Secretary of State Blinken to face hostile Senate Foreign Relations Committee chair, a Democrat who opposed the Iran deal, and the opening of Cuban relations. Meanwhile, new report, poverty declines in 2020 thanks to government payments. Speaking of which, House Democrats released details of its tax package to pay for the $3.5 billion budget bill.
With a T.
Trillion dollar budget bill. And speaking of which, Democrats' reconciliation endgame nears as the bipartisan bill needs to be voted on in less than 2 weeks. And thus, if they're tied together, so too the Democrats' budget bill. UN warns that a million Afghan children could die without food and health aid. Meanwhile, back in this country, inflation slows. The supply chains slowly come online. Top scientists argue there is no immediate need for booster shots. And Amy Coney Barrett says the Supreme Court has been unfairly attacked as being partisan. Meanwhile, irony was rushed to a local hospital. All this and more on today's Majority Report. You really step on a joke when you say Roche instead of Rush.
Rush. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. As I welcome Emma Vigeland. How are you, Emma?
I'm doing well, Sam. How
still
about
have,
you?
Still have Rosh Hashanah on my mind.
Oh.
And as Yom Kippur is coming up.
I was making some jokes with my friends the other day. We were trying to spell Rosh Hashanah. My friend was like, I'm celebrating it. And I was like, it's spelled Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, there you go. Very mm-hmm. quickly.
Yeah.
Folks, a lot to get to today. We California is voting for the recall. There has been a lot of effort deployed. We're going to talk later in the program because I think what we can see in California is the Democrats trying out some strategies for the midterm elections. And from what I saw, at least some of the strategies, or I should say tactics deployed, I think are the right ones. There was real concern as recently as a month and a half ago that Gavin Newsom would lose. It's still possible. And I guess it was about a week ago I spoke with Erwin Chemerinsky, who made the argument, among other things that we were talking about, that the recall is in and of itself unconstitutional, sort of as a function of the result, because there are two questions on the ballot. The first is, do you want to recall Gavin Newsom? And Gavin Newsom essentially can lose the governorship with less than 50% of the vote. So 49%. He could get 49% of the vote, still would lose the governorship.
That's why if you are voting in California, that is the number one thing you need to do is vote no on that first question.
Because the second ballot, which he is not allowed to appear on.
It's nuts.
someone could become governor with 16% of the vote.
And that would probably be Larry Elder.
That Larry Elder. But you understand the problem there, right, in terms of a question of the value of a vote for Gavin Newsom does not carry the weight of a vote for, let's say, Larry Elder or any of the other people who are running. Your vote in the second ballot is much more weighted much more heavily than your vote in the first question, and there are constitutional issues with that. The I think part of the reason why this didn't come up in the last recall was that Gray Davis, I think, actually got less than the amount of the tally of Schwarzenegger who won. So you couldn't make that argument anymore because they didn't get enough votes to even win in the second ballot. But nevertheless, the polls have changed in California, and Larry Elder can read the polls. He also knows that what he really wants to get out of this is a larger platform for his talk radio show. I have had personal experience with Larry Elder back in 2004 at the Republican National Convention. And I'm paraphrasing, but when he wanted to talk to Janine Garofalo and I, who were doing our radio show off air, he's like, come on, guys, we leave that stuff on the field. And we just looked at him and go, like, do you have any idea what your on-the-field antics lead to for this country?
No, it's performance art.
Honestly, that was that was certainly the impression that I was left with. And here is Larry Elder, though, preparing for his possible loss. He is on the Stinchfield, which is a program on...
my last name's clunky, but I'm naming my show after it.
On Newsmax.
You can't tell me otherwise, damn it.
Well, you can imagine that some of the other options were like Stench Town or Stench Country. Well, they just went with his full name. Here is his interview on Newsmax.
For escaping poverty, it's being thwarted by the very party that you pull the lever for every 2, 4, 6 years. I'm going to break that tie, that stranglehold that Democrats have over black and brown voters, and they are scared to death.
Yeah, they won't know what hit them, Larry. Here's my big concern. I call it the mail-in ballot scheme. CNN said that I was setting up the big lie in California, like a do-over from Trump 2020. I don't think it's a big lie. I think there is a mail-in ballot scheme concocted by the Democrats. We saw in one school district where they went to vote, all the Republican voters said that they had already voted. And they said, what the heck's going on? The local news reported on this. Larry, what do you do to overcome this mail-in ballot scheme, as I call it?
Well, I heard about all of that, and I've been asked over and over today by the media, will you accept the results of the election? And I've always said, will Gavin Newsom accept the results when he loses? Because I'm telling you, about 2 million people signed the petition. They have him recalled. About a third of them were the very independents and Democrats who voted for him just 2 years earlier. 65% of Hispanic voters voted for him 2 years earlier. Now the majority of them want him out. The majority of independent voters want him out. So I don't think it's going to be close. I think they're going to recall this man, and there'll be no doubt that the next governor of California will be yours truly, Larry Elder.
Well, Larry Elder, thank you so much for coming on the program tonight. I know you're super busy. I know you've been working hard. I've never seen a guy work so hard. You lost your voice through the whole process, but God bless you. I told you yesterday at the event we were at that you're being bold and you're humble about it, but thank you. I still say thank you for being bold.
Well, I lost my voice and I'm gaining weight. That's what the campaign will do to you.
I love the fact I'm calling to you from some sort of, you know, that's some shaky cam there from Mission to Mars and Disney.
Yeah, exactly. Is he in the Star Wars ejector hatch? Is he on his way to blow up the Death Star?
I like the fact that Stinchfield also notes that, like, oh, incidentally, just in case our audience didn't know, I've been campaigning with you.
Yeah.
Just like, you know,
be bold, right. Like I told you,
fair
buddy.
And balanced. We don't even bother with that. He won't answer that question, of course. And if a recall you could determine simply by the number of signatures there, then you wouldn't actually need the election. somehow the Democrats have also managed in the course of their mail-in ballot scheme to also play with the polling that is out there. And they've also managed to play with the number of Democrats who have responded to the ballots as opposed to Republicans. This is a fairly intricate scheme, as you can tell. Not as intricate as the point made that Larry Elder clearly had shot off into space and so that he could get a good view of the entire state.
He saw a first man with Ryan Gosling, and he's like, I'm the first man to recall Gavin Newsom.
And he's like, they shot the interview as he's doing re-entry into the atmosphere. Or he's just like in G training, right? G force training? Is that what's going on there?
Yeah, he's whipping around a centrifuge.
Or it could have been he's on a roller coaster. We had a whole mess of stuff.
And if his rocket ship combusts, we know it's the deep state.
Can we just play that again? Because maybe they're doing some off-roading.
Yeah, he looks like, you know, in rally driving where there's like one guy driving, one guy reading the map. Like, he's like leaving his driver.
He does sort of look like he's in a dune buggy. There doesn't even seem to be windows in that vehicle.
Maybe he's, you know, he lost his voice, he gained weight, and he's so dehydrated that his hands shaking.
Can't
like
hold
this.
The
is that a winning message to conclude a campaign? Like, I've lost my voice and I'm putting on weight.
There you go. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Adam Tooze, professor of history at Columbia University, author of the Chartbook newsletter on Substack, about his new book, Shutdown: How COVID Shook the World's Economy. We've got a couple of sponsors here, both of which I will use in the future. This I did not realize for a long time. When is the perfect time to plant trees and shrubs? When do you think, Emma?
The spring.
Yeah, that's what I always thought too. But you know what? It turns out the best time is actually fall. Now, you put them in the ground, they make a brief, you put them in, the roots go dormant, and then they are ready in spring to just explode. Of course, I'm talking, I got this information from Fast Growing Trees. Mm-hmm. I have two pear trees that I have already, this is what is amazing about Fast Growing Trees. They don't grow any faster. They're just bigger when you get them. They're the biggest trees you can get basically online. And last year at this time, right, maybe it was in the spring, I can't remember, I planted two pear trees, Hosea Korean pear trees. And Saul and I have been eating them.
Oh, that's sweet.
Has there ever been a partridge in them?
There's never been a partridge in them, and that doesn't come with that. But that's the beauty of these trees. Within a year, I am getting fruit. You can skip the big box store. You head to fastgrowingtrees.com. It is the world's largest online nursery. You don't have to wait in lines. You don't have to shove the tree in the back of your car, bust it, have dirt everywhere. There's no digging through a lackluster selection. You just go to fastgrowingtrees.com. You choose from thousands of varieties of trees, shrubs, and plants, expertly curated to thrive in your area, delivered to your door in 1 or 2 days. Doesn't matter. You could be looking for shade, privacy, fruit trees, or just added color for your yard. I got those bloomerang lilacs. They blossom twice over the course of the year. Every plant is shipped with a well-developed root system ready to explode with new growth. Fall is planting season. Don't let anybody tell you different. Join over 1 million satisfied gardeners at fastgrowingtrees.com. Plus, the 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee means your plants will arrive happy, healthy, and ready for planting. Now through November 30th, go to fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. fastgrowingtrees.com/majority for 15% off. That's 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com/majority, fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. Lastly, we did not get Bradley directly from ZipRecruiter, but we got Brendan through ZipRecruiter, and we got Bradley through Brendan.
Mm.
That's called electricity. That's not a technical term. Look, some things in life we like to pick out for ourselves, right? We know we've got the one that's best for us. Doesn't matter what it is, clothing, mattress, whatever. Well, what if you could do the same thing for hiring? Choose your ideal candidate before they even apply. Well, that's where ZipRecruiter's invite to apply comes in. It gives you, as the hiring manager, the power to pick your favorites from top candidates. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. This is what happens. You post a job on ZipRecruiter. They send you the most qualified people for your job. Then you can easily review the candidates and invite your top choices to apply for your job. Lauren Webb, SVP of Talent Acquisition for Mindula Health, raves about Invite to Apply, saying, "I love that feature because we have much higher fall-through rate if I invite the candidates." According to ZipRecruiter internal data, jobs where employers use ZipRecruiter's Invite to Apply get, on average, 2.5 times more candidates. And that, of course, helps for a faster hiring process. See for yourself. Just go to this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority, to try ZipRecruiter for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. All right, I want to welcome to the program Professor of History at Columbia University, author of the Chartbook newsletter on Substack, and author of his most recent book, Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy. Adam Tooze, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Great to be here.
All right, let me just start with this question. Please take it in the spirit in which it's offered. A historian, you wrote a history book about last year. What inspired you to, and we should say it runs from more or less, you're recounting January 20 to January 20 of 2020 into 2021. What inspired you to do this recounting of that year now, as opposed to, I don't know, 10 years from now? Or
because it seemed urgent. Because like you, and I'm sure the vast majority of other people out there, making sense of last year is a bit of a struggle, and it seems like everyone who has a stake in it and some insights possibly to offer and a platform should do their bit, basically. Why wait around until it's perhaps a little safer to do it? Could I honestly look at myself and say I had something better to do last year and try and figure this out? I was in the middle of doing something else, like most everyone else. 2020 changed my plans. And I was writing about the climate crisis, which I also took to be an urgent and important topic. And at some point in March, well, in fact, I can tell you precisely when, it was on March 9th, basically, Monday, March 9th, when the global markets started to blow up. And all of us who'd been in the business of trying to make sense of 2008 and its aftermath were in touch with each other on finance Twitter, on email, literally just pinging stuff back and forth going, have you seen what's happening in the repo markets? Have you seen what's happening to equities? There was just this huge collective buzz, and in the STEM world, they all struck out and head off to do vaccine work, and those of us who are preoccupied with understanding modern capitalism and democracy and geopolitics had a job to do. And at some point I realized I couldn't do two things at once, so writing books is what I do, so I buckled down and did this. In terms of my identity of a historian, if I had to defend it, you can see I'm not I'm not really taking the bait on that. But if I did have to, I would say, look, what is history? You could say history is the process of looking at archives, which I've done plenty of in the past, or history is the study of old things in the past, also a topic, or history is about the passing of time and this kind of mysterious way in which things which were in the future are now the present and then become the past and how we navigate that space. And if you're interested in that way of thinking about history, then really the present is your laboratory, because I don't need to tell you, in the journalism game, there's nothing quite like taking a position on something which could be invalidated the very next day to sharpen your wits and to sharpen your mind as to how history with a capital H actually impacts us. So that's my view right now, training graduate students, is that everyone ought to write at least a little bit of contemporary history, because unless you do, you don't really understand what it is you're writing about in the distant past.
And we should also say, the lessons that we garner from that year, today, in China, we have a city that has been in lockdown. The four and a half million people, Xiamen, I guess it is, the city. We also had a report today on inflation. I want to talk about that because how we interpret what took place over the course of those 12 months is, it seems to me, invaluable going forward. We're already sort of seem to have like forgotten those lessons. Even today, as a report comes out, that we were able to diminish poverty in this country over the course of the past year, something that we've been unable, or rather unwilling, to tackle. So let's start with the first the actual sort of response to the what came out of China, the way that China handled it. There's sort of this this paradox in that their initial sort of response, I guess, was sufficient, but their sort of like in preventing the crisis, but their response to the crisis on some level was extremely effective, although not necessarily available option for everybody. But talk about that that paradox.
This is where really history does come into play, because if we could stop the clock at the end of February 2020, you would have said this was the biggest disaster for the Chinese communist regime since the Cultural Revolution in the 70s and the beginning of the reform period. It was, as you say, a total failure of their reporting chain after SARS in 2003. They thought they built a bomb-proof reporting chain that channeled information upwards. You've got, I mean, first of all, just to comprehend or try to comprehend, obviously I'm speaking as a Westerner too, but like governing China is like governing South America, North America and Europe all together from one capital city, say for sake of argument in London, right? So reporting chains are your problem. How do you get information up there? And that failed. And as a result, then they dilly-dallied for maybe a week trying to figure out how serious this was. And then they triggered, it's not really clear that they ordered it, but they triggered this extraordinary shutdown, which had huge impacts on their economy. I mean, they buried the information about this pretty deep, but we think unemployment surged above 20%. China is still, though bits of it are very affluent, has a population of about 600 million people who live on, you know, they're not in absolute poverty anymore, but they just get by. And they were shaken in the way that the informal labor market was in Peru or India as well. So there was a huge convulsion. And if you had stopped the clock in February and that was where the game ended, you know, it would have been a disaster for them. But it's as though the whistle blew, the second half started, and all we did in the rest of the game was fire the ball into our own net for 45 minutes and run our own goals. I mean, we really just made unforced error after unforced error after unforced error in the West, so that by April, May, Xi Jinping and the Chinese regime is sort of looking at the situation and going, you know what, I think we won. Which is not how it looked in that early stage.
And so let's talk about that the firing of the own goals end of that equation in the West. We failed miserably by any metric that deals with the spread of the disease, let's say.
Still are failing, right?
What, I'm sorry?
Still are failing. Look at what's going on in the southern places.
Yes. Well, what accounts for that? Was that, is that a function of our response or the constraints that exist in the context of our type of, ostensible democracy?
I don't think it's surprising in the end that it went that way, right? I mean, and it's pretty typical of all the Western states. America, because it's so large, again, it's not fair to compare the United States with Britain or something. If you look at New York, its track record, New York State or the East Coast, it's quite similar to that of the UK. It was very bad in the spring of 2020, quite bad again over the winter. But right now, people have found the modus vivendi. But across the United States as a whole, this country simply doesn't have a fully integrated national health system. It does not have a common culture of concern for science, for basic public health, the fabric of society and the sort of social solidarity that will be necessary. this, sorry, that you see in a city like New York right now. I mean, like the vast majority of people in the subway, overwhelming majority wear masks, not everyone, but the vast majority, adequately enough to contain the pandemic. That's not true for the society as a whole. Then we did, of course, have the Trump administration, which actually was in the business of pitting states against each other and made it difficult, as it were, to spiral policy up from the state level. But again, I would reiterate that failure is, though it, of course, is American and feels American and hurts us as members of this society, it is in fact quite common. I mean, the vast majority of advanced economies failed in this same way. This sort of threat, which is very fast moving, requires systemic responses from societies. It's just not the sort of thing that we are currently very well set up to deal with at all. We, I think, if we are to play to our strengths, have to go other routes. Things like the vaccine are the direction to go in. They get us to a relative place of safety much more quickly than anything else we can do.
Is that a cultural tick, or is that simply that we in the West have not had the experience that maybe Pacific Rim countries have had with near pandemics or epidemics? Or is it there is something just sort of like fundamentally, against our nature to be able to be like sort of cooperate and to accept? I don't know. Is there something endemic in us that made it impossible, or is it just simply lack of experience or that? The vaccine is, and we'll get into this as you discuss it, sort of the almost like the perfect neoliberal response, right? Like, well, why should we actually build a social safety net to respond to something like this when we can actually just deploy a product and make some cash off this?
Take it in the arm, I agree. I mean, in a sense, I don't think we can avoid these questions, these sort of tumbling, spiraling, like, who is it? Who are we? Like these sort of almost existential anthropological questions. I tend to kind of backpedal on them in the sense that I'm not sure there's much evidence that, say, Asian American communities with deep cultural links to China behave radically different in the United States from any other group. The sense, to my mind, is that this is about experience. I think if New York was confronted again with news of a pandemic sweeping across the world, we would be much quicker to talk about shutting JFK than we were in February 2020. You have to open your mind to the possibility of shocks like this. So I think this was crucial for the South Koreans because they'd had a series of near misses. They're right up against China. They had a very nasty run-in with MERS. It actually brought down a government. The government that's currently in there was very, very aware of risk management as a thing. So as soon as they saw this, they knew test, test, test. We've got to have tests as quickly as possible. It doesn't matter whether they're good or bad. We just need tests. That turned out to be absolutely critical because this thing, if you get it early on, is eminently manageable, right? This particular corona one is not a bad one. It's not particular until we got the Delta variant. It wasn't even particularly infectious. So if you could stop it early, it was thoroughly manageable. If you did what London did, what New York did, if the Europeans did during February and March, you're lost. And from then on in, it's just a series of bad options. But I would reiterate, if you're in a city like New York, we had one period, several months that were totally traumatic. And since then, life here has been constrained, but basically stable. And I do think that our reaction, one would hope, and one would seriously call those responsible accountable in future, if there is a report like this coming out of anywhere in the world, and there isn't an immediate move to test and trace out of JFK, we would have to say, like, the bar of responsibility has now shifted. That there are also deep cultural divisions within the United States over issues about science, the culture wars around those kind of issues. We all know that. And that's a matter of history. It wasn't true, for instance, when you think about the polio vaccine. There were street parties, people coming out onto the high streets of the United States to celebrate that vaccine. People queuing up with their children to have them vaccinated. There was virtually no vaccine resistance at that point. So what we would have to come to terms with is that very familiar story of the degeneration of American public culture since the 1960s, the advent of various type of minority, media circles that feed off conspiracy theory. All of that is very familiar. It doesn't, in the end, in a big country like ours, it shouldn't shift the game, because if we can get to 60 or 70% vaccination quickly, we're ahead in the game. If we can adopt basic measures of social distancing, we should be able to contain it. But in 2020, it formed a really toxic cocktail.
this is a little tangential, but what do you think accounts for that? Like what was there some new element that was introduced into American society that led us from having street parties for the polio vaccine to, you know, I mean, it's sort of bizarre, right? Like that we are devolving in that way.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a recurring pattern. I literally just yesterday taught the history of American populism at Columbia, and we were talking about William Jennings Bryan, who's the great populist advocate of the silver money in the 1890s. And in retrospect, every economist in the world would tip their hat to William Jennings Bryan and say, "Look, you got that right. Right? You're absolutely right. The gold standard was ruinous for American farmers. America should have moved to a popular-controlled central bank at that stage," which is kind of where we've ended up in a sense, though it's still an elite institution, obviously. But it does modern monetary policy. But, you know, William Jennings Bryan's sideline by the 1920s was contesting the veracity of Darwinian science in famous court cases. Right. So you have that kind of duality, I think, in American culture and American politics going all the way back. It's quite closely associated at various moments with evangelical religion and are quite, you know. So the funny thing about this skepticism is that it's not, after all, plain superstition. American skepticism takes the form almost of a kind of excessive Enlightenment impulse. People want to do their own inquiries, make their own minds up, find the evidence themselves, right? So there's this weird fine line that we walk constantly between affirming skepticism as the basis of modern science and then say, but only for certain people. Like Dr. Fauci gets to be skeptical, and he gets to change his mind when the evidence changes, like any rational person would do. And the rest of us should just get on and do what he tells us to do and do it quickly and promptly. And that's how we'll be better off. And in a sense, we rely on this strange combination of deference and independence in a very delicate balance. And that balance can tip, and it can quite suddenly tip in different directions. And of course, new sorts of media, which authorize knowledge at different levels, on the one hand, create the, you know, the what we're doing right now, or, you know, the extraordinary wealth of stuff you can find in blogs or in newsletters. And on the other hand, also QAnon in the same space and driven in a sense by the same impulse. So it's a very delicate balance, and it's certainly out of whack in the US right now.
But the QAnon impulse, right, and the impulse to seek one's own knowledge, I think also comes from this sense of, like, honestly, narcissism a little bit that is a bit specific to this time, as you say, like, Dr. Fauci gets to change his mind because he has access to the knowledge base and an understanding of the science, right? He's not above critique. But I think there's also this dynamic where this kind of individualism and this atomization has created a narcissism where people feel that they are on equal footing in terms of seeking understanding.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, I think that's a very interesting idea, actually, that in a sense, the phenomenon of Fauci changing his mind and us being expected to follow him is humbling. I mean, it's the opposite. You know, the insult is that it humbles us, right? And then you have to sort of doff your cap. And so I think this is an extraordinary. I mean, I'm obviously in the business of, you know, I have the privilege of teaching at an extremely selective elite university. So we have, on the one hand, a profound investment in that kind of hierarchy of knowledge, right? That's the basis of our entire business. But in a sense, what we also simultaneously do is encourage a skepticism. And one of the things we definitely do is shape the intellectual personalities of our students. I'm not saying that, you know, lots of Columbia students are vaccine skeptical. They really aren't. But I think this logic is inbuilt. So I'm not sure. I mean, maybe one could conclude that we're in a moment of sort of peak narcissism to that extent, or that's an element at play. But I do think it's a more regular pattern. I mean, I found the work of the sociologist Ulrich Beck, the German sociologist, profoundly helpful. Stuff I first read in the 80s, and he did this at the time of the Chernobyl crisis. So if you were in Europe in the mid-80s, you know, this nuclear reactor blows up in Ukraine, and all of a sudden, we were confronted with very COVID-type questions. I wasn't there. I grew up there, but I was in touch with folks. And it was like, can I take my kids safely to the playground? Exactly how contaminated is it when we say contaminated? I mean, is it, you know, how bad is cesium really for the bones of small children? Were the sorts of questions that, which is exactly the sort of thing that we were dealing with. And what Beck describes beautifully is this spiral of expertise, counter-expertise, and this profoundly ambiguous balance between the acceptance of hierarchy, which is a kind of unmodern impulse, and this corrosive skepticism, which tumbles you into something that's indistinguishable from superstition.
Yeah. I want to get to the economic stuff too, but this is sort of fascinating to me too. And I have to say that I think like, I'm biased here, but there was, George W. Bush really tilled the ground for an anti-intellectualism. Mm. And there's not just this element of narcissism. Why does Anthony Fauci get to do this and I don't get to decide? There's also this sort of acknowledgement, like, he's sort of been studying this stuff for a while. Like, you know, there's been an investment in, he didn't get there because he wasn't just sort of like picked out of a line and like, yeah, you, I like you. It wasn't nepotism theoretically, right? I mean,
he's not just reading memes on the toilet, for example. You know,
there is like.
But the painful sociology of this, right, is that it's, I mean, another way of formulating is that it's a really bad idea if the distribution of education maps onto party political affiliation. Right. So if you look back to the 1980s, Reagan voters actually leaned college educated. So in areas of the US with high percentages of college educated folks, the GOP was scoring more highly there. And what we've seen is a flip, right? And this is particularly dangerous perhaps when it happens on the right, where you've got all these other memes of religiosity and nationalism playing into the mix. But now, of course, we know that the GOP has a huge incentive in a sense to play towards the folks who didn't have the benefit of college education and carry with them lifelong resentments of various types, but for very good and obvious reasons, about the intellectual and professional hierarchy that results from the education to which they didn't have access. And I think that's certainly part of the toxicity of the current moment, that the two parties are, you know, very polarized in terms of their relationship to, frankly, colleges, to universities, to academia, to research, to that hierarchy of science and knowledge. And that makes a very unstable dynamic. I mean, and Trump was the kind of culmination of that. I think in fairness...
Well, hopefully, culmination.
You know, hopefully, but in fairness to the Bush administration, they were major funders of global pandemic preparedness in the early 2000s because of the bioterrorism threat.
Right.
So you can steer this back in the national security direction. You know, you can get bipartisan grip on this.
Right. That anti-intellectualism. I mean, I guess there's been a strain of that in sort of the reactionary right, for a while. I mean, Gertrude Himmelfarb was talking about why we need to attack science and sort of so-called objective reality. But let's move towards the more recent reality in terms of when we talk about the response, and you've written about the 2008 financial crisis and the response that we had there, and the pivot to austerity was more extreme in Europe, but it was rather quick in this country as well. And the mechanisms that were set up were mostly bank shots that ostensibly, you know, almost trickled down on some level in terms of the way that we had hoped to deal with the financial crisis in 2009. This time around, we didn't do it that way. But you argue that to assess at least that year, and maybe the reconciliation budget bill will be sort of like will change the tenor of what took place that year, but that it was a little bit early to say that, at least from a ideological perspective, the era of Reaganism and Thatcherism is over. Our behavior was different in our response, but it was still maybe within that context of that framework, and maybe the reconciliation may change that in hindsight, but we'll see. But will you talk about that element of it, that even though we gave money to people directly and reduce poverty, we're still sort of stuck in a neoliberal framework for the way that government operates?
No, I mean, it's an incredibly confusing picture, I think. And people are scratching their heads and asking themselves how far this was a break. And the book is, you know, part of that head scratching, you might say. And I do think on this count, it is simply too early to make a final judgment, even just in direct comparison with 2008, because the austerity push that you alluded to in Europe and the US begins in 2010. Paul Krugman had this great line that it all went wrong in 2010. And that's 2 years out from 2008. So we're not there yet. The real test will be 2022 in so many ways, right? The midterms in the United States, the debate in Europe will kick off about how to return to or not the fiscal rules there. Both the ECB, the European Central Bank, and the Fed will be by that point under real pressure to end the massive interventions they've made. So already the pieces seem to be falling into place for something that looks a little bit more like 2010 than is at all promising or comfortable. I think that's worth saying to your followers that we're not there and people should really pay attention because this is the bit where it gets serious. During the crisis itself, it's relatively easy to take action. In both 2008 and 2020, this depended on essentially a coalition in terms of driving it, in terms of the intellectual cognition and driving this between, in the US, a coalition of the Treasury and the Fed, both under the control of Republican appointees, and the centrist Democrats in Congress. So Schumer and Pelosi, in fact, both times, playing key roles in this. And it's that which anchored that which anchored the response. And that's one of the reasons for thinking in terms of continuity here. There is a direct continuity of personnel. And the crisis, of course, massively amplifies the profound social inequalities which mark the era of neoliberalism since the 1970s. And the basic aim of policy, though it was undoubtedly to help people in distress, and as though we did discover that if you send checks to poor people, you can in fact raise incomes, surprise, surprise, the basic intention of strategy in 2020 everywhere in the world was totally conservative. The one thing that we wanted to do was to come back to where we were at the beginning of the year. It's literally the plan. And that meant handing out money to everyone. So yes, for the first time in American history on the scale that we saw in 2020, checks were directed to low income, middle income and families in precarious situations. But at the same time, hundreds of billions of dollars went towards business and various types of tax cuts. The shift finally comes with credit where credit is due in the March 2021 bill. The rescue plan, the first phase of the Biden three-phase plan, is in fact the most directly targeted stimulus measure we've ever seen, targeted at middle and low income families. But does it fundamentally change the structure of their disadvantage? Clearly it doesn't, right? And it doesn't have that aspiration. Nor did we see during the period of the crisis in the US any concerted effort, because people were too desperate to just pump money out the door, to save fix the unemployment insurance system, which is crucial to actually alleviating stress around the country in moments of crisis, let alone move to the next level of the European system of having a short time working model where people aren't made unemployed in the first place. So this was, to that extent, a kind of mega status quo policy. But when you look at the things that the central banks and the treasuries were doing, it's utterly radical, which is why I end up thinking about earlier periods of history where we have this weird, this famous quote that, you know, for everything to remain the same, everything must change. And that, I think, quite nicely encapsulates the situation that we're in. Or a colleague of mine, Daniela Gabor, whose name you may know, coined this phrase of a revolution without revolutionaries. So that, I think, describes the situation. Most of the neoliberal players are there. The ground rules of society and social inequality are unchanged. The purpose of policy was conservative. And then we just did whatever it takes. So it's a kind of radicalized conservatism, if you like.
There's two or three strains that sort of really stick out to me. To the extent that, and again, the, we were already sort of primed to lose the sort of deficit hawkery, that the that MMT, modern monetary theory, was already sort of primed, and you know, we had plenty of evidence from quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3 that you could actually pump all this cash into the system and it not be problematic. I mean, you know, we had, you know, PIMCO was selling their bonds in 2011, arguing we're about to become Weimar, and I guess not. And that it didn't happen. So we were really primed for this. And it seems like, you know, the deficit hawkery was also killed insofar as, like, you know, Paul Ryan packed up and took his roadshow home and nobody was around to talk about that. What amazes me is that when Joe Manchin goes on television and talks about, like, the deficit and pretends like there's an inflation problem, that he's not laughed out of, like, society at this point. Like, I mean, this should be considered
quackery on the level of, you know, like what we need to do is drink silver to get rid of COVID. And yet there's just this like sort of real difficulty in giving up the ghost by the conventional wisdom.
But don't you think that, I totally agree, but don't you think in the background lurks so other unspoken things?
Well, absolutely. It's just they don't want the taxes.
Yeah. It's A, taxes, and B, what are we spending and who are we spending the money on? And if you think back to the Tea Party mobilization, I think that's evidently, you know, that was not an anti-bank bailout mobilization. It was an anti-welfare mobilization against the black president who was going to deliver welfare to ordinary people. That was exactly what they were indignant about. So it's when the state gets into the business of changing the social structure in a way that, that certain, you know, defensive white entitled groups feel defensive about, that's when this stirs up. As you say, it can't really be about inflation. No one could possibly take that seriously. I think it's these other issues which are underlying and unspoken, and that's really what this all stands for.
Do you think that's just like an abject failure of the media at this point? I mean, because it is, Joe Manchin's out there, he mumbles something about inflation, and no serious thinker at this point perceives a legitimate serious inflation threat. We've just had a complete usurpation of our and we don't seem to have really reacted to it in any way, but our supply chains, there's an awareness that, like, you know, a shipping container now costs 11 times more than it did a year and a half ago because they're, you know, in disparate corners of the world. But there doesn't seem to be any type of like attempt to address like, hey, maybe we shouldn't be getting all this stuff from different places. Maybe we should grow it here. But he says inflation and the media just sort of like says, oh, he's saying inflation. That must be serious on some level. I mean,
he has outriders. Like, I mean, think about Larry Summers' role here. He's quite significant, I think. And it wasn't just Summers. It was people like Blanchard, who's, you know, the French economist who used to be chief economist at the IMF. So, and it's not as though it isn't a reasonable question to ask yourself, but you should ask it in the spirit of, hang on, like, there should be inflation, shouldn't there? Why isn't it showing up? Let's have an inquiry into this. Whereas what you see is this sort of fear-mongering, scaremongering, you know, this talk about irresponsibility. And I think it chains on itself. And so, you know, clusters of inflation fear-mongering form, they reinforce each other. And in the media itself, there are many people who are low-level, small-C conservatives on this kind of issue. The mainstream of the 1990s is, you know, is hard to kill. And, you know, we should, in a sense, concede to them that it is, after all, kind of puzzling. You know, the back of the envelope, MV equals PT, quantity equation, more money chasing the same number of goods kind of theory of inflation is, after all, intuitive. You know, when you teach a high schooler about economics, that's kind of where you start. And it's not, after all, such a bad idea. You know, it kind of makes sense. So we should recognize that the fact that it just doesn't seem to apply for the last 20 years, if you go back to Japan, is kind of mind-blowing. So I think that's the space in which that sort of conservatism percolates. But it's very, I totally agree with you that in a sense it's frustrating that it's not more regularly challenged. It's not, as it were, exposed as the, and I think stalking horse for a certain sort of conservative, I mean, it's clearly just a stalking horse for a certain sort of conservative politics. And Joe Manchin doesn't want to do certain bits of the infrastructure bill. He's particularly leery about the green stuff, which is unsurprising given his, you know, deep investment in the coal business and the fact that he represents West Virginia. And it's kind of as simple as that at some level.
Right. Let's talk about what this has revealed in terms of our ability to deal with crisis, broadly speaking, and the just sort of almost the just sort of relentless refusal to change anything structural to deal with that. I'm thinking, you know, like the one thing I think we did get was the $300 child payments for children that may have some durability going forward. And I think that on some level that is a sort of a structural change, at least in terms of the way that the people relate to their government. But like, I also look at things like, we're going to subsidize COBRA as a way of providing health insurance. It's the most inefficient and short-term response to, you know, what could end up being a problem again in 2022. And so where does that leave us? And of course, it's also a question in terms of climate change. You have a the pet food test. Talk about that and just talk about, I guess, like sort of this failure for us to deal with changing anything structural, learning anything that could be of use next time around.
Yeah. So, I mean, I am driven by that same rather pessimistic diagnosis, so much broken, so little fixed. Why can't we develop reform momentum on a large scale to a focus on technology? Not because I'm a techno-optimist, you know, one of these people who loves atomic power and just can't think of enough reasons why we ought to have more nuclear reactors or whatever. That's a sort of desperate last resort. I mean, given the impasse, you know, what is it that we think that will move red states to the recognition that electric power might actually be great? And furthermore, they can generate it through the abundance of natural bounty of, you know, wind and sun in so many of the red states. They should be green energy powerhouses. Well, you could try and talk to them nicely about science and the future, or you could just try and sell them a really butch, incredibly powerful electric car with massive amounts of torque that right. also you can power your house with. You don't even need a generator when the miserable American electric grid fails because the wires hang out on wood poles that get blown down whenever the weather gets extreme. So, you know, which one of those two strategies is more promising? I'm definitely betting on the Ford F-150, the latest model. Like, that is a way in which you build consensus. You downgrade the cultural differences and you begin to just move this into the mainstream as something cool and better that everyone's going to adopt because people are smart and they understand this. But then the next question is, okay, so if we're serious about science and this is our best bet, this is my question to any, you know, Republican who's in good faith, because this has been their good faith strategy on climate back to the Bush era, like we're going to bet on technology. So what is the scale of our bet? How serious are we about this? And this is where the pet food test comes in. So how much money, I love my dog, I really love my dog. How much money do Americans spend on pet food and treats for dogs and cats? Every year, Americans spend $35 billion. What is the federal government's current budget for fundamental energy research? Less than 5. So we are $35 billion, by the way, is no small amount of money. That buys you half of the Pentagon spend on R&D, pure R&D, not the R&D and TBIT, which takes you over $100 billion. Pure R&D, according to the American National Association of Science, $75 billion in the Pentagon. So $35 billion, to my mind, is like what the rest of us ought to, as it were, cough up if we are at all serious about these problems. And you would have thought that $35 billion would be the sort of place where you would put, not over 5 years, not like in the Biden plans, not stretched out, right here, right now, every year. So say we shot for a pandemic, biotech, climate preparedness program in the order of $50 billion a year. If you did it over 10 years, you'd be in $500 billion territory, which begins to put you within striking distance of you-know-whose program, Bernie Sanders, the Green New Deal, $10 trillion all in for all the investment program. So that's how I kind of go. In a sense, you loop back, right? You start with the conclusion that really American society is going to be incredibly difficult to shift. You conclude that really things like, you know, smartphones and computers and great tech does move society. And then you ask yourself, okay, so how do we supercharge that? And then you say, okay, what is our benchmark for spending? And it's much more manageable in some senses than the huge figures that you cite for infrastructure. And it may provide a workaround. It's a little bit the way in which Africa, for instance, has just sidestepped landline telephones. Everyone on the continent pretty much has a phone. And then on those phones, they can do incredibly smart fintech type stuff. So in East Africa, you've got much better fintech than in most of the United States. And these are countries at much lower levels of income, and they've just sidestepped certain old technologies in a kind of burst. That might in the end be, and I don't say this with enthusiasm, it's more just for want of any obvious alternatives.
So in other words, the any legacy technology, I mean, I guess it's nice to have this as a hopeful, but any, you know, technology that we were to develop now or 10 years ago when we really should have been would be legacy technology that would be sort of maybe holding us back from taking a more productive step forward.
Yes. And we need to just be making maybe an order of magnitude larger investments in these future technologies, especially if what we're thinking about is, you know, preparedness for shocks like the COVID crisis, which don't give us any time at all, right? So for those, we need standing capacities. The reason why we were able to move so rapidly on this virus was in part because we'd done a lot of basic research on in 2003 on SARS and then dropped it because, you know, the epidemic ran its course before the vaccine was relevant. But that's the model that we need, and we need to do it deliberately, intensively, in advance, on a large scale. And again, these are manageable amounts of money, and it's, you know, an economy the size of the US, $18 trillion plus, you know, spending $50 billion on something which is inherently valuable after all, like science, biomedical research is not something we should shed any tears over spending money on. These are great jobs, fantastic occupations, very meaningful lives for all of the people involved. We should, that's what we should be arming, and we should really be raising our game in that dimension.
It feels like if we can't do this now, it's hard to imagine a scenario as to when we could do it.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the, for so long, climate folks have told themselves, look, it's going to take some nasty, massive shock. You know, Kim Stanley Robinson's vision of some horrendous crisis in India shifting the game. And after COVID, I'm actually really struggling with this idea, because what I see more often than not, even in discourse around climate and the pandemic, it's as though climate trumps the pandemic. If you look at Biden's plans, where are the big budget items in there for specific pandemic preparedness? They're just not there. It's really striking. Like the big money is in, you know, electric mobility and so on, which is great, obviously. But it's as though we flee out of the current moment into the devil we know. I mean, at least that's, you know, the climate's a problem we're kind of familiar with now, and we've been worrying about it for decades. But it's as though we haven't checked the fact that, in fact, there could be another one like this 5 years from now that's even worse, which means we don't get to first base on the climate issue, right? And this isn't to downplay climate. It's just to force us to realize that it's all these things at once, right? You've got to be able to process that whole package.
It does feel like our society is not necessarily very well situated to respond to, I mean, our problems. I mean, it's almost as if everybody's saying, like, well, lightning is not going to strike twice. We probably should have been more prepared for this one, but what are the chances of this happening again? And like we can imagine, like, well, we got by on some level 600, like you say, COVID wild type is a fairly, you know, this is not bleeding out of your eyes type of situation. This is not, you know, it could have been like an Ebola and had the ability to be communicable, you know, like, you know, Delta, and we got lucky, but there's no reason to think that we won't next time, or in terms of climate change. Can't tell you how much I appreciate the conversation. Adam Tooze, professor of history at Columbia University, author of the Chartbook newsletter on Substack. People can go sign up for that. We'll put a link to that and to Shut Down, How COVID Shook the World Economy. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Thank you.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we will wrap this up. So meanwhile, during the break, of course, we're just sitting around going like, oh, my God, we are really, as a society, maybe totally screwed.
Not in good shape.
Circling the drain.
Circling the drain. So much rides on this reconciliation bill as both an assessment of what we have learned from this era and as to what's possible going in the future, and whether, you know, we just simply revert back to the ways that left us in this sort of era of incredible wealth inequality and unpreparedness and society that is sort of like, strung together with duct tape and chewing gum. Well, we're going to subsidize the most inefficient way of developing health, of delivering healthcare, instead of creating some system that's, we just plug and play. It's already there, and it can scale automatically to a crisis. We'll see. But for those of us on watching us on Peacock, we will talk more about this tomorrow.
We will see you then.
For those of you who are watching us everywhere else or listening to us, we'll talk about it now. God. Yep. Honestly, we're down to 2 weeks. If the reconciliation bill is not voted upon simultaneously with the bipartisan infrastructure bill, so-called, or just ahead of it, all the leverage is gone.
Yeah.
All the leverage is gone, because Joe Manchin, certainly the Republicans, a lot of the establishment in the Democratic Party, more than happy to walk away and just pass the bipartisan bill, trumpet that, $500 billion of new spending, and tax cuts, no addressing of all of the other elements of home elderly care, of expansion of Medicare, of any type of greening of our economy, any type of dealing with climate change, any type of paid leave, parental leave. I mean, all of these different things that are in this. I'm forgetting a whole host of things, universal pre-K, free community college, on and on. All of that, they are more than happy for that not to happen. And it's all going to come down in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, question to you before the show started and I think it's a stupid question, just an off chance that Republicans could vote to pass the bipartisan bill and then sink the reconciliation bill in the House, but they're not going to do that because Pelosi's not going to bring it up for a vote, right?
Republicans can't sink the reconciliation bill. I mean, all you need is a majority.
But you can, and you can, as soon as the bipartisan bill is passed, that gives somebody like Manchin the ability
conservative Democrats could, Republicans.
Right, but by voting for just the bipartisan bill and advancing it, overcoming that block of progressives that would be sinking it and holding it hostage, sapping the energy from the reconciliation bill. That's like a
second scenario. The first scenario is that the bipartisan bill has to get voted upon. And once it's voted upon, without the reconciliation bill, all the leverage goes away from the reconciliation. And the second scenario is that the Democrats say, well, you haven't brought the reconciliation bill. I'm not going to vote for the bipartisan bill. I think you'd be hard pressed to find 60 Republicans in the House, let's say, if 60 Democrats stuck together. But it's possible. It's possible that they could push the bipartisan bill through and then thwart.
Is that the length, the breadth of the block? 60 for the Democrats?
We don't know.
That's my point, is it could be smaller than we think.
If it's 10, it's possible you could have 10 Republicans do it. That would allow, on some level, that lets the progressives off the hook, right? I mean, because then they get to a vote against the bill that they know is going to pass anyways. It's hard to know how many Republicans would vote for it, and hard to know how many Democrats would vote against it in that scenario.
It's very, yeah.
And this is also, let's be clear, right? I mean, and we'll take a break and we'll talk more about this, but Biden needs this.
Yeah.
It's not like Pelosi needs this. This gets reported as a defeat for Biden, for Schumer, for Pelosi. They
They may want to massage the contours of this and may not want, and like, you know, as much of an expansion of Medicare and this and that, but they need this bill to come in somewhere between, it seems to me, 2.7 trillion and 3.5 trillion, not to look like they lost. They certainly need the budget to pass, in some fashion. All right, we're going to take a break. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Help the show thrive and survive. Meanwhile, know me.
What's
up? Purple background.
I know. It's.
Are you in a cave? Story.
I am in a cave. I'm in a wine cave. Listen, I decided we're just going to go all in. We're going to, you know, go to the Met Gala and just go full wine cave.
Like you wear a tax the rich dress?
Damn it. 107. It comes up.
Oh my God, that's all I wanted to talk about today, guys.
Well, we will talk about it. I think it's
it's a great exercise in understanding how we build movements, I think.
We will talk about that
I don't want to talk about it because I think I didn't like it.
Oh, I didn't like it either. Yes, you are a little bit echoey. Don't worry about that. What vintage will you be supplying on your show this week?
I'm a big fan of cheap older wines, which means I'm actually on vacation this week. I'm on break this week. So we did a bunch of amazing pre-tapes with people like Ryan Grimm, who talks about the conversation that Biden had behind closed doors. He reported on it, but it was from Obama's Wars, that book that came out like 11 years ago or so, about just his challenging the generals, and the generals just like laughing at Biden at the time. And then we have Matt Brunig on. And then we also have, what else do we have? Oh my God, I have a list here because it was a bunch of pre-tapes. You know the jam, Sam. And both of you, you do them back to back. Oh my God. My old friend, Alex Shepard. We talked to him about how the media was just blowing the Afghanistan coverage, and many more. It's really, really, I have to say, even though I was on break, I'm on break now. It was a jam packed week of really thoughtful interviews. So I definitely encourage you to check it out at youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. And I can promise you one thing. We are not having any conversations about fancy dresses. But I would have.
There you go. Well, you can have it now. We'll have it in a minute. Speaking of fancy dresses, Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, he came in wearing a ball gown today.
Oh, my God. He looks so stunning.
Yeah, I'm wearing a ball gown to promote the newest episode of The Literary Hangover on with Dr. Charles Keeney, Chuck Keeney, on the battle, or his book, The Road to Blair Mountain, on the Battle of Blair Mountain, which is sort of like the Gettysburg of U.S. labor, or Guernica of U.S. labor, depending on how you want to phrase it. And that's one of my favorite episodes of Left Reckoning. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get access to that. We're probably going to make it public, but if you want to support the show, we're like 4 or 5 away from 900 patrons. So.
Dude, 4 or 5 of you. You can be number 900, or even 899 is an honor.
898 is good too.
898 has certain symmetry. 897 has a feeling of anticipation.
Yeah, these are all very poetic numbers.
If it was 987, we could make a joke.
Listen, if it's 1111, I'm really into it. That's like a very spiritual thing for all of the, this is not the crowd for that. I know you're looking.
I'll reserve 1111 for you, Naomi.
Wait,
you know what I'm talking about. It's like everybody on the internet screenshots every time it's like 111 or 1111. I don't know what it means. It's like an angel is like,
never heard of that.
You know, frolicking above you.
You're supposed to make a wish at 1111.
Yeah, well, it's also the passcode to my phone.
Emma.
Not really. It's not.
You don't even need that new hacker to like go in there and update your phone.
Right, try it.
Folks. We will see you in the fun half. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. You can IM the show by using our app, which is totally free. You get it at majorityapp.com. While you you can, it's, we have iOS or what's the other one?
It'd be Android.
Android, that's right. And when you get the app, The Israeli government apparently knows that you're downloading the show. So that's a big boon for us.
Got our Israeli metrics.
Exactly. Really well. That's the way we get our metrics now. But become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget the Majority Report Discord, majoritydiscord.com. We got a merch store, all of it. Check it out. And lastly, our newsletter, the AM Quickie. Go to majority.fm, scroll down, sign up for the newsletter. You will not be sorry you did. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Nightmare!
Bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.